time, it has been known that these are meteors which enter the Earth's atmosphere at high speeds and burn brightly as they heat up. It is thought that most of these are space dust, which is leftover material from the creation of the solar system 4.5 billion years ago, along with comets and other asteroids. Determining exactly what materials these heavenly bodies are made from has been of interest for many years, since this information could help us understand how the solar system was formed and may also account for the chemical composition of the Earth. Analyzing the material composition of meteorites has given us some tantalizing clues, but the problem with these specimens is that they have all been heated to extremely high temperatures by their passage through the atmosphere. Wouldn't it be nice, the people at NASA thought, if they could capture some of these objects out in space and bring them back to Earth in a pristine state? The first problem with this idea is that objects in space tend to be traveling rather fast. Space dust is often going at speeds of 50 kilometers per second, which equates to 18,000 kilometers per hour, a lot faster than a bullet. Catching an object like that is not easy. As with stopping a bullet with, say, your body, either the force of the bullet exceeds the rupture pressure of your skin, meaning it goes through you, or you employ a bulletproof vest made of a high rupture strength material, such as Kevlar, which results in a compressed and deformed bullet. Either way, it's a risky business. However, in principle, it is quite possible. Just as when catching a cricket ball or baseball with soft hands, the trick is to spread and dissipate the ball's energy rather than bracing yourself for a single high-pressure impact. What NASA needed then was a way to slow the dust down from 18,000 kilometers per hour to zero without damaging the dust or the spacecraft, ideally a material with a very low density, so that the dust particles would be slowed gently without being damaged. Ideally, one that could do so within the space of a few millimeters, and ideally one that would be transparent, so that scientists could find the tiny specks of dust once they were buried in it. That such a material existed was a minor miracle. That NASA had already used it in space flights was extraordinary. It was, of course, silica aerogel. The mechanism by which aerogel pulls off this feat is the same as the one used to protect stunt actors in movies when they fall off tall buildings, a mountain of cardboard boxes, each box absorbing some of the energy of the impact as it collapses beneath the actor's weight, and the more boxes, the better. In the same way, each foam wall within aerogel absorbs a tiny amount of energy when it is struck by the dust particle, but since there are billions of them per cubic centimeter, there are enough of them to bring it to a halt relatively unharmed. NASA built an entire space mission around the ability of aerogel to gently collect stardust. On February 7, 1999, the Stardust spacecraft was launched, containing all of the equipment necessary to take a trip through the solar system, while also being programmed to fly past a comet called Wild 2. The idea was that it would collect interstellar dust from deep space as well as the dust being ejected from a comet, allowing NASA to study the material composition of both. In order to do this, they developed a tool that resembled a giant tennis racket, but instead of holes between the strings, there was aerogel. During the summer and autumn of 2002, while in deep space, millions of kilometers from any planet, the Stardust spacecraft opened a hatch and poked out its giant tennis racket fitted with aerogel. It had no opponent in this game of interstellar tennis, and the balls it was looking for were microscopically small, the remains of other stars long gone, the leftover ingredients of our own solar system still flying around. The Stardust spacecraft couldn't hang around in deep space too long because it had an appointment to keep with the comet Wild 2, now hurtling from the outer reaches of the solar system and approaching the center, which it does every 6.5 years. Having withdrawn its aerogel tennis racket, the spacecraft sped off for its meeting. It took just over a year to get to the right position, but on January 2, 2004, the spacecraft found itself on a collision course with the comet, which was 5 kilometers in diameter and speeding off around the sun. Once it had maneuvered itself into the slipstream of the comet, 237 kilometers behind it, the spacecraft opened its hatch and once again poked out its aerogel tennis racket, this time using the B-side, and started to collect, for the first time in human history, virgin comet dust. Having collected the comet dust, the Stardust spacecraft returned to Earth, arriving back 2 years later. As it approached the Earth, it veered away, jettisoning a small capsule which fell under Earth's gravity, entering the atmosphere at a speed of 12.9 kilometers per second, the fastest re-entry speed ever recorded, and so becoming for a while a shooting star itself. After 15 seconds of free fall, and having reached red-hot temperatures, the capsule deployed a drogue parachute to slow down the rate of descent. A few minutes later, at a height of 10,000 feet above the Utah desert, the capsule jettisoned the drogue chute and deployed the main parachute. At this point, the recovery crews on the ground had a good idea of where the capsule was going to land and headed out into the desert to welcome it back from its 7-year, 4-billion-kilometer round trip. The capsule hit the sand of the Utah desert at 10:12 GMT on Sunday, January 15, 2006. "We feel like parents awaiting the return of a child who left us young and innocent, who now returns holding answers to the most profound questions of our solar system," said the project manager, Tom Duxbury, of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. However, until they opened the capsule and started examining the aerogel samples, scientists had no idea whether they held any answers to anything. Perhaps the space dust would have passed straight through the aerogel, or perhaps the violence and deceleration of re-entry would have disintegrated the aerogel into meaningless powder, or perhaps there would be no dust at all. They need not have worried. Once they got the capsule back to the NASA laboratories and opened it up, they found that the aerogel was fully intact and almost completely perfect. There were minuscule puncture marks in the surface, and it was these that were subsequently shown to be the entry points for the space dust. Aerogel had done the job that no other material could do. It had brought back pristine samples of dust from a comet formed before the Earth even existed. Since the return of the aerogel capsule, it has taken NASA scientists many years to find the tiny pieces of dust embedded within the aerogel, and the work continues to this day. The dust they are looking for is invisible to the naked eye, and so it must be found by microscopic examination of the samples, which has taken years. The project is so massive that NASA has enlisted the public to help with the search. The scheme, Stardust at Home, trains volunteers to use their home computers to look through thousands of microscopic images of the aerogel samples and try to spot the signs that a piece of space dust is present. The work so far has thrown up a number of interesting results, the most surprising of which is that most of the dust from the comet Wild 2 shows the presence of aluminum-rich melt droplets. It's very hard to understand how these compounds could have formed in a comet that had only ever experienced the icy conditions of space, since they require temperatures of more than 1200 degrees Celsius to do so. Since comets are thought to be frozen rocks that date back to the birth of the solar system, this has come as a bit of a surprise, to say the least. The results seem to indicate that the standard model of comet formation is wrong, or there is a lot more we don't understand about how our solar system formed. Meanwhile, having completed its mission, the Stardust spacecraft has now run out of onboard fuel. On March 24, 2011, when it was 312 million kilometers away from Earth, it responded to a final command from NASA to shut down communications. It acknowledged this command and said its final goodbye. It is currently traveling off into deep space, a kind of man-made comet. Now that the Stardust mission is over, will this be the fate of aerogel too, to end in obscurity? It is all too possible. Although aerogels are the best insulators we have, they are very expensive, and it is not clear that even now we care about energy conservation enough to value aerogels economically. There are several companies selling aerogel for such thermal insulation applications, but at the moment the main ones are for extreme environments such as drilling operations. It's possible that, because of environmental considerations, our energy costs will get higher and higher. In a sufficiently high-cost energy future, it is conceivable that the monolithic double glazing we are all used to may be replaced with a much more sophisticated glass material based on aerogel technology. Research on developing new aerogels has been taking place at an increasingly rapid pace. There are now a number of aerogel technologies that result in a material that is not rigid and brittle, as silica aerogels are, but flexible and bendy. These so-called X-aerogels are made flexible by a neat piece of chemistry that detaches the rigid foam walls of an aerogel from one another and inserts between them polymer molecules that act like hinges within the material. These X-aerogels can be made into flexible materials such as textiles and could be used to make the warmest but lightest blankets in the world, potentially replacing duvets, sleeping bags and the like. Because they are so light, they would also be perfect for outdoor clothes and boots designed for extreme environments. They could even replace the foam soles in sports shoes that make that type of footwear so springy. Recently, a family of carbon aerogels have been created which conduct electricity, as well as super-absorbent aerogels that can suck up toxic waste and gases. So aerogels may yet be part of our everyday lives, the answer perhaps to living in a more extreme and volatile climate. But although as a materials scientist it's good to know that we are likely to have the right materials to offer the world in the event that global warming is not averted, this is not the kind of future I want for my children. In a world where we have industrialized so many materials, including those we used to hold sacred, such as gold and diamond, I like to think there may again be a place for a material valued solely for its beauty and significance. Most people will never hold a piece of aerogel in their hand, but those who do never forget it. It is a unique experience. There is no weight to it that you can perceive, and its edges fade away so imperceptibly that it is impossible to see where the material stops and the air begins. Add to this its ghostly blue color, and it really is like holding a piece of sky in your hand. Aerogels seem to have the ability to compel you to search your brain for some excuse to be involved with them. Like an enigmatic party guest, you just want to be near them, even if you can't think of anything to say. These materials deserve a different future, not of oblivion or embedment in a particle accelerator, but to be valued for themselves. Aerogels were created out of pure curiosity, ingenuity, and wonder. In a world where we say we value such creativity and give out medals to reward its success, it's odd that we still use gold, silver, and bronze to do so. For if ever there was a material that represented mankind's ability to look up to the sky and wonder who we are, if ever there was a material that represented our ability to turn a rocky planet into a bountiful and marvelous place, if ever there was a material that represented our ability to explore the vastness of the solar system while at the same time speaking of the fragility of human existence, if ever there was a blue sky material, it is aerogel. 6. Imaginative. While doing my PhD at the Materials Department of Oxford University, I regularly went to cinema matinees. Watching films in dark, empty movie theaters soothed my brain in a way that no other form of relaxation could, especially on grey, rainy afternoons. One day, though, something strange happened. I had a blazing row with a stranger in the foyer. The film being screened that afternoon was Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, a classic western starring Paul Newman and Robert Redford. Before the movie started, I was in the queue to buy a bag of candy when I heard the guy behind me bemoaning how sad it was that cinemas had lost their magic and become glorified shops selling overpriced confectionery. He was in the queue for this very same confectionery he professed to hate, I noted, but the inconsistency wasn't enough to override my British reserve. It's what he said next that really got to me. "Why are all the sweets sold in plastic bags?" he said. "In my day, they were paper. The sweets were stored in jars and sold by the weight in paper bags." I did a half turn, clasping my bright orange shiny packet of chocolate, met his eye, and, smiling, said, "But surely plastic has the most right of all materials to be in a cinema, especially in the context of this film." Maybe my tone was a bit condescending. It probably was. I was a PhD student and thought I knew quite a lot. But I was also keen to defend plastic, a material that is often misrepresented. I had picked the wrong person, though. He tore into me with the full force of an authoritative film buff. What poppycock was I talking? What did I know about cinema at my age? He had lived and breathed it in its golden age. Cinema was about the stars of the silver screen, the flickering lights, the velvet seats, and the whir of the projector. He didn't listen to a word I said, and in truth he was probably right not to. Whatever the factual basis of my argument, I didn't have the language to convey it in a meaningful way. In the end, we both went into the cinema scarlet with rage and sat at opposite sides of a largely empty auditorium. I breathed a huge sigh of relief when the lights finally went down. I have often thought of that humiliating episode and wondered how I could have defended Plastic more effectively. I have come to the conclusion that the only way he would have heard my argument is through the medium that he valued most, the visual language of cinema. So here it is, a screenplay to settle the argument that I lost about the relevance of plastic candy wrappers to the film Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. At times, my rudimentary screenplay and its relevance to my cinema foyer argument are perhaps a little obscure, so each scene is followed by a few explanatory notes. Scene 1. Interior, Saloon Bar, San Francisco, 1869. It is early afternoon. Chairs and tables fill the room, half of which are occupied by men playing cards and drinking. There is a piano in the corner that no one is playing. The bright California sun filters through the blinds, which are broken and make a rattling noise when the wind blows. Cigar smoke lingers in the air. The occupants of the saloon are a collection of rough-looking men, mostly out of work. Some are ex-miners who came out west during the California Gold Rush 10 years earlier and then gravitated to the city, having failed to get rich. Others are veterans of the Civil War who have wound up here as guns for hire. A few women keep them company. In the corner there is a billiards table to accommodate the new craze for pool, using 15 colored billiard balls. Bill and his younger brother Ethan are playing. Bill is a cowboy who came to the city on the run from killing a man in Ohio. He is a largely silent man with a toothless smile on account of having his teeth knocked out by a horse. He has persuaded his younger brother to travel out here with him, using the new railroad to make their journey. Ethan, over the pool table, about to play a shot. Blue ball, corner pocket. Bill, leaning against the wall with cue in hand. Yeah? Ethan smashes ball into the corner pocket. Yes, sirree! I like these new balls. I most definitely do. Bill. Yeah? Ethan. Yeah. Adopts a fake posh accent. Made for a man of leisure, don't you know? That's us, right, Bill? Men of leisure. Ha! Ethan goes on to pot a further two balls, keeping a running commentary in his fake posh accent and grinning at Bill in between each successful shot. Bill takes no notice, distracted by an argument at one of the card tables. A red-faced man, a newcomer, has finally worked out he's being systematically cheated at cards and rises to his feet quickly but unsteadily as his chair tips over behind him and smacks violently on the floor. The rest of the table laugh. The red-faced man is so drunk that the thoughts going through his head are clearly visible on his face. He considers tipping up the card table and walking out, but then his hand finds his gun and he starts to wag it at the other players. The laughter stops, and after a few seconds, everything in the saloon stops, except Ethan, who has his back to the room and has been lining up another seemingly impossible shot. Ethan, fake posh voice. Blue ball, end pocket! In the silence, he plays the shot, but something strange happens when the white ball hits the eight ball. There is a bright flash accompanied by a loud percussive crack. The eight ball misses the pocket, knocked off course by the mini explosion. The red-faced man, whose befuddled attention had started to turn towards Ethan, is so startled by the noise that he instinctively reacts by letting off one shot in the direction of the pool table before running out of the saloon. Ethan lies bleeding on the floor as the white ball finally comes to a halt, still smoldering from its explosive collision with the eight ball. Notes for Scene 1. The game of pool evolved from billiards, a 15th-century Northern European game that started in royal palaces and was essentially an indoor version of croquet. This is why the table surface was colored green, to simulate grass. One of the results of the Industrial Revolution was to make billiard tables much cheaper to produce. As in our day, it was found that the game could increase the income of bars and public taverns, and it started being adopted by the new urban poor. During the 19th century, the game got more technically sophisticated. First, the cue sticks became tipped with leather and covered in chalk to allow greater control of the ball by using spin. This technique was introduced to America by English sailors and is still referred to as putting English on the ball. In the 1840s, the invention of vulcanized rubber by Charles Goodyear allowed for the introduction of cushions at the sides of the playing surface, which were soft and springy instead of wooden, ensuring that the balls would bounce off them in a predictable manner for the first time. From this point onwards, billiard tables resembled those we know today. The move from a billiard game, which uses 3 or 4 balls, to the more fashionable game of pool, which uses 15 balls, happened in 1870s America. Up until this point, though, the balls themselves were made of ivory, and so were expensive. Ivory has a unique combination of materials properties. It is hard enough to endure the thousands of high-speed collisions between the balls without denting or chipping. It is tough enough to not crack. It can be machined into the spherical shape of a ball, and like many organic materials, it can be dyed into different colors. No other material at the time had this combination of properties, so when the popularity of pool exploded into a craze across American saloons, there was a real chance that the price of ivory would rise so much in response to demand that the game would rapidly become unaffordable. Hence the trial in many saloons across the continent of balls made of new replacement materials, such as plastic, some of which behaved very strangely. Plastic was a new kind of material, as different from other materials as screenplays are to prose. Scene 2. Interior, a shack in downtown New York. The shack is serving as a laboratory for John Wesley Hyatt, a young man who works as a printer of newspapers, but in his spare time conducts chemical experiments. At the age of 28, he already has one patent to his name, and is about to go into the history books as maker of the world's first usable plastic. He is being visited by General Lefferts, a retired soldier and investor, who, having already financially backed the young Thomas Edison, is now interested in Hyatt. Lefferts, a big, formal man, is having to stoop to avoid hitting his head on the roof of the shack, which is full of glassware, wooden barrels, and a surprising amount of ivory. There is strong smell of solvents, even though the windows are wide open. Hyatt, I got the idea for what I want to show you when I was trying to make synthetic billiard balls. He gestures to the corner of the room, where there is a box of assorted billiard balls. Lefferts, billiard balls? Why billiard balls? Hyatt, currently they can only be made from ivory, but it's too expensive, and the game is so popular nowadays that the billiard table manufacturers are getting spooked that they will run out of it. So they put an advertisement in the New York Times with a reward of $10,000 for anyone who could invent a substitute material. Lefferts, $10,000? Shoot, there can't be that much money in the game. Hyatt, who is fiddling with his chemical apparatus, breaks off what he is doing to search for something and quickly locates it pinned to the wall. It is a yellowed newspaper clipping of the New York Times reward advertisement. He hands it to Lefferts. Hyatt, see for yourself. Lefferts, reading the article while puffing away at a cigar. Phelan and Colander, America's largest billiard supplier. I've never heard of them. Continues to read silently, mouthing some of the words, and then quotes a passage. We offer a handsome fortune of $10,000 to any inventor who can create a replacement material for ivory. Well, well, can it be true? Hyatt. Oh, it's true, all right. I've been working on the problem for several years now and have supplied them with many prototypes. A few months ago, they contacted me to say that they had sent several sets of my latest versions to saloons around the country on a trial basis. Lefferts. So you succeeded? Hyatt. Well, yes. Looks down as if not sure how to continue. But there's a problem. Let me show you how I made them, and then you'll see. In fact, that's really why I brought you here, because you have to see this to believe it. Hyatt finishes off fiddling with several bits of his experimental kit and then takes out a large Dewar, a type of vacuum flask, from a locked cupboard and starts pouring from it a clear liquid into a beaker. Hyatt, this is the key to it all, and it was under my nose all the time. Lefferts, What is it? Hyatt, it's a preparation of nitrocellulose in alcohol. Lefferts, nitrocellulose. I have heard of that. Yes, but isn't that an explosive? Lefferts is suddenly red-faced, upset at his own naivete in coming to visit this crazy scientist and putting his own life in danger. He fingers his cigar nervously. He has seen enough stupid accidents with explosives in the Civil War. Hyatt, not picking up on Lefferts's concern. Oh, I think you mean nitroglycerin, yes. I suppose it is a little similar chemically, but this is nitrocellulose, which isn't technically explosive. Perhaps it's slightly explosive, highly flammable, certainly, but I am very careful. He turns to Lefferts at this point to smile, and then realizes that Lefferts is upset, and so goes on to give further explanation by way of smoothing things over. Hyatt, nitroglycerin is made by nitrating glycerol, which is an oily, colorless liquid that results from soap manufacture. You just mix the glycerol with nitric acid. But, as you say, it is very unstable and is the key ingredient in dynamite. What I have here, however, is nitrocellulose, which is made by mixing wood pulp with nitric acid. If you dry it out, it becomes something called gun cotton, which is highly flammable, I grant you, but, turning again to Lefferts, doesn't really explode. In the liquid form I am using, known as collodion, it does something rather interesting. Watch. Lefferts watches as Hyatt puts a few drops of red ink into the beaker of nitrocellulose solution, which goes bright red. He then dips a wooden ball, suspended on a thread, into the liquid. When he pulls the ball out again, it is coated with a beautiful glossy red plastic, which quickly hardens. The transformation has the required effect on Lefferts. Lefferts. Incredible! Can I touch it? Hyatt, looking pleased. Yes! Well, no, it needs to dry a bit more, but here are some I made earlier. Lefferts, handling the artificial pool balls, knocking them together in his hands. So you've solved it. What's the problem? Is it still flammable? Lefferts takes the cigar out of his mouth and gingerly pokes it at the pool ball, which smoulders and then bursts into flame. Hyatt deftly picks the flaming ball out of Lefferts's hands and throws it out of the window. Hyatt, well, yes, they are flammable. That's not ideal, of course. In fact, there have been some reports that when the balls collide at high speed, they can spontaneously ignite. But the real problem is the sound. When the balls knock together, they just don't sound right. Lefferts, ah, who the hell cares what they sound like? Hyatt, oh, they care. I care, too. But that's not what I wanted to talk to you about. Here, take a look at this. He takes an object out of a drawer and hands it to Lefferts. Lefferts looks at it for a while. An ivory comb. So what? Hyatt, it's not ivory, smiling delightedly. Ha! I fooled you. It's a new material made from this same cellulose nitrate that's coating the wooden ball. But, in my new process, the ball isn't needed. I can make whole objects purely from the cellulose nitrate. You just add naphtha, a solvent derived from crude oil, and hey presto! The process is called plasticization. He excitedly starts scrabbling about in his drawer. Here's a hairbrush, and here's a toothbrush, and here is a necklace, handing them to Lefferts. Lefferts is silent for a while as he inspects the fake ivory objects. Lefferts, quietly. How big is the market for ivory? Hyatt, big. Very big. Lefferts, what do you need to start producing this, what is it called? Hyatt, it's made from cellulose, so I call it celluloid. What do you think? Lefferts, it's fine with me, whatever you want to call it. What do you need to start producing celluloid on an industrial scale? Hyatt, time and money. Notes for Scene 2. All of this is factually accurate, even if the dialogue is somewhat approximate. These days it is hard to believe that anyone could make fundamental chemical discoveries in their shed. But in the late 19th century, the beginning of the golden age of chemical engineering, a growing understanding of chemistry coincided with entrepreneurial opportunities for making money out of the invention of new materials. It was also easy and cheap to get hold of chemicals, sales of which were mostly unregulated. Many inventors were operating from their homes, and in the case of Goodyear, from debtor's prison. Once his rubber proved itself, the demand for the protection, comfort, and flexibility of this type of material grew. The term plastic refers to a huge variety of materials, all of which are organic, which is to say they are made of a group of compounds based on carbon, solid, and moldable. Goodyear's rubber was a form of plastic, but it was the invention of wholly synthetic plastics that revolutionized the term. John Wesley Hyatt and his brother set up a lab in their shed to do just this, inspired in part by an advertisement in the New York Times that offered $10,000 to anyone who could invent a new material for billiard balls. Hyatt was also financially backed by a syndicate of investors led by Marshall Lefferts, a retired Civil War general. There were complaints about Hyatt's exploding collodion-covered balls from saloon owners, one of whom reported that every time the balls collided, every man in the room pulled a gun. These days, pool and snooker balls are made from a plastic called phenolic resin, and celluloid is only used for making one type of ball, the table tennis ball. Scene 3. Interior, a funeral parlor, San Francisco. Ethan's body is lying naked on an operating table. His clothes, which have just been cut off, are lying on the floor. There are several other new bodies lying on benches around the room, blood dripping from some of them into little pools. There is a strong smell of chemicals combined with the sweeter, more pungent smell of decay. The embalmer is cleaning up the blood on Ethan's body as Bill looks on.
Bill. So how long have I got?
Embalmer. To get his parents here?
Bill nods.
Embalmer.
3 days under normal circumstances.
Bill, through clenched jaws.
And what about abnormal circumstances?
Embalmer. Well, I've got some of the new formaldehyde. With enough of that, we can preserve him pretty good, but it's expensive. I can do something cheaper with arsenic, but he won't look the same.
Bill is silent, staring intently at his dead brother, saying nothing.
Embalmer. So I hear it was the new billiard balls that did him in. The ones made by that New York fella? I was reading about him in the newspaper. A scientist and inventor, so they say, like Edison, who made those electric lights. But not as successful, by all accounts.
Bill. New York? Is he wealthy?
Embalmer. Must be, I guess.
Bill starts walking out.
Embalmer. Hey, where are you going? What shall I do with your brother's body?
Notes for Scene 3. In 1869, although the principles of refrigeration were known, it would be another 50 years before refrigerators themselves started to become available. In hot countries, there were only 2 options when someone died, to bury or cremate them, or to embalm them. Embalming methods were based on alcohol or special solutions containing toxic chemicals such as arsenic until 1867, when formaldehyde was discovered by the German chemist August Wilhelm von Hofmann. Unlike previous methods, formaldehyde preserved the tissue in such a way as to give the corpse an almost lifelike appearance, and it soon became the method of choice. Lenin, Kemal Ataturk, and Diana, Princess of Wales, were all embalmed with formaldehyde. These days, a new technique called plastinization has been developed by Gunther von Hagens. This involves the removal of water and fat, such as lipids, from the body, and their replacement, using a vacuum technique, with silicone rubber and epoxy resin, a hugely versatile material that is used in all sorts of paints and adhesives and flexible products. Like formaldehyde, this produces a lifelike appearance, but because of the stiffness of the plastics used, the bodies can be set into lifelike poses. An exhibition of these preserved and posed bodies, Body Worlds, has been touring the world since 1995 and has been seen by millions. Scene 4. Interior, courtroom in New York City, some years later. Hyatt is being questioned about his patent rights on the new celluloid plastic, from which his company is making a lot of money, manufacturing everything from combs and hairbrushes to cutlery handles and even dentures. The lawyer questioning him has been hired by Daniel Spill, an English inventor who claims to have invented a similar plastic, xylanite, 1 year earlier. General Lefferts, Hyatt's financial backer, is in the front row of a largely empty courtroom, listening to the arguments.
Lawyer. You say that you invented celluloid by attempting to create a replacement material for billiard balls?
Hyatt. Yes, that is correct. I was using collodion to coat wooden balls to give the effect of ivory, but I realized that if I could find a way to make the coating into a solid material, I could do away with the wood, and maybe make a material that sounded more like ivory.
Lawyer. Sounded like ivory? Your story seems rather far-fetched, wouldn't you say?
Hyatt. How many times do I need to explain? Any billiard player will tell you that the click of the balls is part of the pleasure of the game.
Lawyer. So you deny receiving information in 1869 from London about a material called xylanite, which uses precisely the same process to turn precisely the same material. Consults his notes. Cellulose nitrate into a near identical solid plastic material using, consults his notes again, using camphor as a solvent? This is the key step, is it not, that you use to turn collodion into what you call celluloid? Are we to believe this is pure coincidence?
Hyatt. No! I mean, yes! I do deny it, absolutely! Going red with exasperation. I found the method entirely on my own.
Lawyer. Whether you did or did not find it on your own is hardly the point, Mr. Hyatt. As you well know. The point is that there is a prior patent protecting the key process that you are employing in your manufacturing business, and that patent belongs to my client, Mr. Daniel Spill of London, England, to whom you have paid no money.
Hyatt. Daniel Spill? Ha! He's not an inventor. He's just an opportunist, a businessman, and a bad one at that. He took all his ideas from Alexander Parks, a true scientist, the inventor of Parkscene. Spill just copied him, and now he wants to make money out of my honest labors. Turning to the judge, who is not paying attention. It's a disgrace, Your Honor.
Lawyer. So are we now expected to believe that you were somehow aware of the work of Alexander Parks and yet wholly oblivious to the work of Mr. Daniel Spill?
Hyatt. What work of Spill? His material doesn't work. If through some technicality I don't own the patent rights to celluloid, then Spill certainly doesn't either. It was Alexander Parks who made the first plastic in 1862. Everyone knows that. Parks just couldn't get it to work right. But I did, not by copying, like Daniel Spill, but through my own work, my systematic experimentation. Turning to the judge, who appears to be quite bored and is fiddling with his pocket watch. I just want to run my business without being preyed on by financial parasites.
Lefferts has been listening intently throughout, but at Hyatt's admission that he knew of Parkinsine, Lefferts looks down for a while, contemplating something, then gets up and leaves. Notes for Scene 4. Despite the existence of earlier plastic-like materials, celluloid is widely recognized as being the first commercial moldable plastic. At the International Exhibition of 1862, the British metallurgist, chemist and inventor Alexander Parks presented a very curious substance to the world, one made of vegetable matter, but that was hard, transparent, and plastic. He called it Parkscene. He, too, had been obsessed with collodion as a potential plastic, but he had never managed to find a suitable solvent with which to turn the nitrocellulose into a moldable material. It was Hyatt's use of camphor, an odious-smelling gum found in wood, that did the trick. It enabled him to make celluloid into an affordable plastic material. At the same time, in England, Daniel Spill had resurrected the Parks process, filed for more patents, and launched a similar plastic called xylanite. Although xylanite failed commercially, Spill decided to sue Hyatt on the grounds that he had a prior patent on the use of camphor as a solvent in the process. The patent dispute with Daniel Spill almost caused Hyatt's business to close. It was the ruling of the judge
that neither Spill nor Hyatt could claim the patent rights to nitrocellulose plastic, which opened up the whole plastics industry to huge competition and innovation. Scene 5. Interior, boudoir of Mary Louise Young in the town of Boulder, Colorado. Mary Louise is a successful businesswoman who owns the town's only shop. As she talks to Bill, she sits in front of the mirror, preparing herself for the evening, combing her hair and trying on jewelry. Mary Louise.
Oh, Bill, you only want to marry me to get your hands on my money so that you can be off again on your travels. I know what you're up to.
Bill. There's a man I have business with in New York, but I'll be back as soon as it's taken care of.
Mary Louise laughs.
So it's true. Well, if I marry, I want to marry for love, Bill. I want to walk down the road arm in arm. I want to take out the horse and cart and go to a picnic at Orchard Creek and have you feed me grapes.
She giggles at the thought of it.
Bill. A picnic?
Mary Louise.
Yes, Bill, a picnic. I want to feel respectable and free. That's what I want marriage to bring me. And I want you to go to the dentist. I won't marry anyone who doesn't have teeth. I reckon that's for certain.
Mary Louise is trying on various necklaces. Bill gets up angrily and rips the necklaces roughly out of her hand and throws them in the corner.
Bill, why do you care about this crap?
Mary Louise,
Bill, stop it! You always get like this when we talk serious.
Bill, it's just plastic, Mary Louise, plastic. It's not real jewelry. Just like you are not a real lady. It's fake jewelry for a fake person.
Mary Louise.
At least I have aspirations, Bill, and standards. If you want me to take your proposal seriously, you know what I expect from you.
Notes for Scene 5. The celluloid business boomed in the 1870s, and the material was molded into a huge variety of shapes, colors, and textures. Importantly, it could be made to closely resemble much more expensive materials such as ivory, ebony, tortoiseshell, and mother-of-pearl, and the early forms of plastic were used primarily in this way. Its being relatively cheap to make meant that huge profits were possible from the selling of all manner of plastic combs, necklaces, and pearls to the growing middle class, who were thirsty for the material wealth of the rich but couldn't afford it. Scene 6. Interior, a dentist's office. A plain wooden room with a large chair in the middle and several tables with an array of metal instruments. There is a certificate hanging on the wall which states that Harold Clay Bolton graduated from the Cincinnati School of Dentistry in 1865. There is a single window in the room which looks out over some scrubland. It's midsummer, hot and humid. Dentist.
Sir, please take off your shirt and sit down here and get comfortable.
Gesturing to the dentist's chair. Bill sits down without removing his shirt.
How much is this going to cost?
Dentist.
I don't know yet. It all depends on what you need.
Bill.
I need teeth. It's pretty simple.
Dentist.
Yes, sir, but I need to look in your mouth first to see what kind of dentures are going to work. I'm afraid your shirt may get dirty if you keep it on.
Bill.
You ain't doing nothing. You're just looking, right?
Dentist.
Yes, but...
Bill.
So do it.
Dentist. I need to take a mold of your gums from this material, showing Bill some powdered plaster of Paris, and then, depending on how many extra teeth you need, I can use either rubber or this new, rather exciting material, which feels much more comfortable in the mouth.
Bill. I don't care. I just want it to work.
Dentist. Oh, this new celluloid definitely works. It's marvelously easy to mold and...
Bill. What?
Dentist. Celluloid. It's very new, very modern, utterly soft, but also hard, if you know what I mean. Which is ideal for our purposes. Everyone is using... Breaks off as he sees that Bill is getting angry.
Sir, did I say something wrong?
Bill.
God damn it! Is there no place safe from that damn stuff?
Dentist.
But, sir, plastic really is the best stuff, and so comfortable in the mouth.
Following Bill, who has gotten up and is walking toward the door.
Sir, I don't understand. What's the matter?
Putting his hand on Bill's arm. Bill angrily pulls away, takes out his gun, and points it at the dentist.
Bill, I'll tell you what the matter is. You are the matter!
Wagging his gun at the equipment and dental materials.
You are all the matter!
Notes for Scene 6. Oddly, Hyatt did try to build a celluloid business out of creating plastic dentures, but celluloid wasn't suited to that application, mostly because the fake teeth warped in the heat and tasted strongly of the camphor used in their production. Their competition wasn't much better, though, made of rubber and tasting of sulfur. Denture wearers had to wait until the 20th century before acrylic plastics to give them a much more pleasant, neutral-tasting and natural feel.
Scene 7. Interior. Hyatt's office, New York. George Eastman, a camera manufacturer, has come to visit Hyatt in his office, which is a glass-partitioned corner on the second floor of his celluloid factory.
Hyatt. So, I believe we could create a camera body that would be much more lightproof than your wooden boxes, since they would be made in one piece, and also much less heavy than the metal equivalent.
Eastman. I didn't come here to talk to you about the cameras.
Hyatt. No?
Eastman. No.
Eastman is quiet for a while. With his back to Hyatt, he watches the processes going on in the factory below.
How thin can you make celluloid?
Hyatt. Thin? Well, I started the business by coating things, if that's what you want.
Eastman, turning to face Hyatt, clearly having made up his mind about something.
How much do you know about photographic plates?
Hyatt. Not much. They're made of glass, aren't they?
Eastman. Yes, that's right. Glass that's been coated in a light-sensitive gel.
Hyatt.
So, you want to use celluloid instead of the gel?
Eastman, looking mischievous.
I want to use celluloid instead of the glass.
Hyatt, trying to work out why.
So the photographic plates are less easily broken?
Eastman.
Do you know how many glass plates a photographer can carry, along with all the other equipment he needs?
Hyatt shakes his head.
Eastman. 10, maybe 15 maximum. You practically need a pack animal to carry it all. It's so heavy and cumbersome. Or at least a servant or two. The whole thing is very expensive. A rich man's game.
Hyatt. You think plastic photographic plates will make it cheaper?
Eastman.
I want to turn photography into something everyone can do. So cheap and easy that you could take a camera to a birthday party, or a picnic, or on holiday, or...
Hyatt. To the beach!
Eastman. Precisely. To do that, we need to make the camera smaller and lighter. But crucially, I need to get rid of the heavy glass plates. Looking seriously at Hyatt. I have developed such a camera. The trick is to put the photographic emulsion onto a long, flexible strip. That way, 20 or 30 pictures can fit rolled up in a tiny canister. I'm calling it a Kodak camera, and everyone will be able to afford one. I will bring photography to the whole world.
Hyatt. So this flexible strip, you have this technology already?
Eastman. Well, no. We've been using paper, but it doesn't really work.
Hyatt. So, what? You want to use celluloid instead?
Eastman. Is it possible?
Notes for Scene 7. Glass was an excellent material for photographic plates, being both transparent and chemically inert. But the plates were heavy, cumbersome, and expensive, limiting photography to the professionals and to the rich. Celluloid film was developed by George Eastman as a replacement material for glass plates and was as central to the photographic revolution as his invention of the compact Kodak cameras. By changing from glass plates to a flexible film of celluloid, which could be rolled up, he made the camera much smaller, lighter, cheaper, and simpler.
He brought photography to the masses, and in making the camera portable and cheap enough to be used informally, he created a new way of sharing family memories through photography. We now live in a time when buying a roll of film is a rarity for most of us, since the technology has been largely replaced by digital technologies. Nevertheless, the invention of celluloid photographic film was a pivotal moment in visual culture. Scene 8. Interior, Hyatt's office, New York, a few years later. It is past midnight. All the lights in the factory are off except one upstairs in Hyatt's office, where Hyatt is fiddling with a strange apparatus. Hyatt hears a noise and looks up. Hyatt. Who's there? Hyatt returns to working, but then hears another noise. Hello? Is there anyone there? Is that you, Betty? The door handle of his office twists slowly and the door swings open. For a moment, no one can be seen, but then the figure of Bill appears out of the gloom. He is drunk. Bill.
Well, looky who's here.
Hyatt. Who are you? Are you the night watchman? Please get out and do not disturb me again. Bill.
No, I ain't the night watchman, but I have been watching you.
Hyatt. What do you mean? Get out! Getting up. Get out, do you hear?
Bill. No, you ain't ordering me around. As a matter of fact, it's me who's going to order you around.
Gets out his gun and points it at Hyatt.
Sit down.
Hyatt, I haven't got any money here, if that's what you want. It's all at the bank. It's taken there every day.
Bill. I said sit down.
Hyatt. Who are you?
Bill. You killed my brother. So I guess I am going to return the favor and kill you. That sounds fair, doesn't it? So that makes me your executioner.
Hyatt. What are you talking about? I haven't killed anyone in my life. There must be some mistake.
Bill. Ain't no mistake. You made the billiard balls that killed him. It's taken me a while to track you down. Nigh on 10 years it's been since he got shot. But here I am.
Hyatt. Yes, I did hear something about someone being shot in a saloon while playing pool with my new balls. But it was an accident. It wasn't my fault. I wasn't there.
Bill. It was your fault. It's all your fault. Shut up! I'm going to put a stop to all this nonsense.
Gestures to the factory.
It ain't natural, and that's why my brother died. You messed with nature, putting this stupid plastic material everywhere, making them believe it's valuable like ivory, making money out of women's desire for trinkets, making fools of them, but not me. You ain't making a fool out of me with your stupid plastic teeth. Someone has to put a stop to this, and it's going to be me.
Hyatt, please, please don't kill me. Please, listen to me, please. This material, this plastic you hate, is about to do more for you and your kind than it ever did for anyone else. It's about to immortalize your way of life. It may even turn you into a kind of god. I've seen it.
Bill, what are you talking about? More crap.
Hyatt, the problem of making it photographically sensitive has been solved. Moving pictures, haven't you seen them? Stories told on the silver screen. Heroes like yourself. Cowboys fighting, winning the West. Everyone is queuing up to see them in the cities. All because of this wonderful, flexible, transparent material. It couldn't be done with anything else. Storytelling will never be the same again. Look, I've got a projector here. I've just been trying to feed in the film. Let me show it to you.
Bill. No, it's nonsense. It's all...
A light appears behind Bill, and the noise of a man's footsteps. The night watchman appears, carrying a lantern. Night watchman.
Is everything okay, Mr. Hyatt? I heard shouting.
Bill runs off, knocking the night watchman to the ground as he makes his escape. The lantern smashes, and the naked flame ignites a bucket of discarded celluloid film. Hyatt and the night watchman try to put the fire out, but with so much flammable celluloid material on the worktops and in boxes nearby, it quite quickly gets out of control. They make their escape and can only watch from the road as the whole factory is destroyed by the fire. Notes for Scene 8. The invention of the roll of film, made possible by the use of celluloid plastic, led directly to the technology of motion pictures. The idea that a picture could be made to move by sequentially showing small changes in the image had been known for hundreds of years, but without a flexible, transparent material, the only way it could be made to work was using the rotating cylinder of a zoetrope. Celluloid changed everything, allowing a sequence of photographs to be taken on a roll of film and then played back fast enough for the picture to appear to move. This not only allowed a longer sequence of motion to be shown than with the zoetrope, but the moving image could be projected, and so the experience could be shared by the whole audience of a theater. This was the key insight of the Lumière brothers and led to the establishment of the cinema. Let's consider for a moment the Wild Bunch, a gang of train robbers led by Butch Cassidy in the late 19th and early 20th century. The exploits of the gang typify what we think of as the Wild West, a time of outlaws and violence, which carried on alongside the development of all sorts of modern technologies, such as trains, cars, planes, and of course plastics. The gang's exploits would no doubt have receded into obscurity were it not for the 1969 motion picture starring Paul Newman as Butch Cassidy and Robert Redford as the Sundance Kid. This movie was shot on celluloid film stock, and like many westerns, it immortalized and romanticized a way of life that long predated it. The plastics that followed celluloid, such as bakelite, nylon, vinyl, and silicone, built on its creative power, and have also had an important impact on our cultural psyche. Bakelite became a moldable replacement for wood at a time when the telephone, radio, and television were being invented and needed a new material to embody their modernity. Nylon's sleekness took on the fashion industry, replaced silk as the material for women's stockings, and then spawned a new family of fabrics such as lycra and PVC, as well as a group of materials called elastomers, without which all our clothes would be baggy and our pants would fall down. Vinyl changed music, how we recorded it and how we listened to it, and along the way it created rock stars. And silicone, well, silicone turned imagination into reality by creating a plastic form of surgery. Without plastics, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and all other movies would never have existed. Neither would the cinema matinee, nor the cinema itself, and our visual culture would be very different indeed. So, although I am no fan of excessive plastic packaging, I hope I've shown that if there is one place a plastic candy wrapper should feel safe and appreciated, it is most definitely in a cinema. Fin. 7. Invisible. In 2001, while traveling the country roads of Andalusia in Spain, I experienced a mesmerizing visual effect. I was driving through one of the region's many olive plantations. As the trees that lined the road rushed past, I found myself catching glimpses of the groves moving repeatedly into perfect alignment, flickering like an old silent film. It was as if the ancient olive trees were performing a magic trick for me, in order to relieve the boredom and sticky heat of the journey. These brief snapshots of line after line of trees stretching seemingly to infinity were addictive. I watched the road, and then the trick, then the road, then the trick, then I hit a tractor. To this day, I have no idea how it got in front of me. When I slammed on the brakes, I was launched out of my seat toward the windscreen. As I smashed my way into it, I remember the moment of contact with the glass, a sudden and intimate freeze frame as it cracked around me. It felt like hitting a wall of transparent ginger snaps. Sand is a mixture of tiny bits of stone that have fallen off larger bits of rock as a result of the wind and the waves and other wear and tear that stones have to put up with. If you take a close look at a handful of sand, you will find that a lot of these bits of stone are made of quartz, a crystal form of silicon dioxide. There is a lot of quartz in the world because the two most abundant chemical elements in the Earth's crust are oxygen and silicon, which react together to form silicon dioxide molecules, SiO2. A quartz crystal is just a regular arrangement of these SiO2 molecules. in the same way that an ice crystal is a regular arrangement of H2O molecules, or iron as a regular arrangement of iron atoms. Heating up quartz gives the SiO2 molecules energy, and they vibrate. But until they reach a certain temperature, they won't have enough energy to break the bonds that hold them to their neighbors. This is the essence of being a solid. If you keep heating them, though, their vibrations will eventually reach a critical value, their melting point, at which they have enough energy to break those bonds and jump around quite chaotically, becoming liquid SiO2. H2O molecules do the same thing.